myself. I was born in Egypt, and I came here when I was actually 9 years old. And, you know, it was kind of a culture shock for me because I came from Egypt and I ended up in Indiana, which is completely different than Egypt. And when I got there, people, when I told them I was from Egypt, they really didn't believe me. They thought, like, Egypt didn't exist anymore. It was somehow like the Roman Empire. You know, like, what? Ancient Egypt? Are there mummies? And, you know, they think that I lived in pyramids and rode a camel to school. That was like the number one question I would get. Do you live in a pyramid? Couldn't understand why they didn't know, like, why they thought I lived like 2,000 years ago. And I quickly found out that most of the time when they learned about Egypt, it was like in Sunday school about Moses. And they thought like Egypt disappeared after Moses crossed the Red Sea or after Jesus spent some time there. And that's pretty much as they got to see about Egypt, or, you know, if they watch like movies like The Mummy, and the more, or, you know, cartoons that depicted ancient Egypt, but there was very little about current Egypt or the current Middle East or Arabia or other cultures. Very little, if anything, about Islam. People thought, you know, they asked me, do you worship cows? And I'm like, no, that's something else. But then the more I looked into it, I found that, you know, Hollywood and the media has been telling stories about Muslims and Arabs for a long time, and it hasn't been a very nice story. So for the most part, and really most Americans and most people around the world today get their information from television, especially things that they don't know about. And so the more, if people are giving misinformation on TV or in the media about a certain place, then that can shape people's perspectives. And so obviously television and the news has a lot of impact on shaping people's perspectives, and more today. And it continues to grow with the rise of social media, Facebook, Twitter, so many ways that people share information now, and it definitely impacts the views of the public. Now, if you take somebody that's, for example, in Africa, they're not going to share the same perspectives that we have here in America because they're watching different television or different commentary. It's a different culture. For example, people that we see here are the enemy. When you go to those people's countries, guess what? They're saying that the United States is the enemy. So, you know, when I was growing up, the enemy back then that's often depicted as the evil people were the Soviet Union, you know, the Russians and the scary Russians. And I remember movies like Rocky, and he went and fought this Russian guy in Russia and beat him. And we were always like, yeah, beat the Russians. Well, you know, the Soviet Union is over. And for some reason, whether it's politics or media, they always have to have, you know, some sort of bad guy out there. And unfortunately for us, Muslims are taking on that role today, not by choice. This is what I do. I run an organization called United Voices. I'm actually helping young people of color to come to bring them to the political process, educating them on the importance of civic engagement, running for office. I think America is going to be better if we have more diversity in our government. If the government looks like the people, then it will be a better place instead of just having a government full of white people only, or majority white people, and it's not reflective of the great diversity of our nation. Here's a picture of myself and my kids. I actually have another kid after that, but I couldn't find a picture where all of us together, where I look nice. And so you can maybe find that on my Facebook, but I have a new child. She's 15 months old. Her name is Miriam. But a little bit why I got into this work of civil rights, human rights, public affairs. I wasn't always like this, but an incident that happened a few years ago, actually in 2002, changed my perspective forever. And it involved these three guys. They actually lived right here in Pinellas County. Have you ever heard of Robert Goldstein? Anyone? No, most of you haven't. Now, how many of you have heard of Osama bin Laden? Yeah, a lot more. Now, Osama bin Laden was in a cave in Afghanistan. Now, this guy lived in Pinellas County in Largo, right down the street. You probably never heard of him. But I heard of him. The way I found out was in 2002, Robert Goldstein, he was a podiatrist. a physician that works on feet. Yeah, it's not a joke. He really worked. That was his specialty, to help people with their feet. And he got arrested because he was having a domestic violence incident with his wife, which is Christy Goldstein. And when the cops showed up and she was said, you know, I'm scared for my life. He has so many guns inside. She gave them permission to search their house. And when they searched their house, they found this. They found so many assault weapons, Uzis, fully automatic machine guns, and they found many homemade bombs, things that the average podiatrist should not have in their house. And they had like a townhouse, and it was just stashed with weapons everywhere. And they found this document. This document, which was very disturbing, this is page one of three pages. And on top there, highlighted in yellow, says, objective, kill all the rags at this Islamic Educational Center, zero residual presence, maximum effect. And rags meaning rag heads, meaning people who put rags on their top of their head, referring to the Muslims that attend and worship at this Islamic Education Center. It's right here up the street on 66th Street in Pinellas Park. It's, I think, 66th and 94th. If you're ever in the area, just make a left there on 94th from 66th Street. You'll see the Islamic Education Center. This is actually a map of a layout of the Islamic Education Center. The square places there, it says parking lot, you know, building. At the top there, do you see in the top right corner, it has the playground and basketball court. Do you guys see that? Yeah, so this guy and his three co-conspirators actually had all these weapons, and they had the map and they had the plan, and the objective was written out what they planned to do at this Islamic Educational Center, which I happened to attend because I used to live in St. Petersburg, and where, you know, my family attended. And it was shocking that, one, this was going on, and he was planning to do this on the anniversary of 9/11, the one-year anniversary. 9/11 happened, of course, on September 11, 2001. He wanted to carry out this assault. Robert Goldstein, write down the name and look it up on Google, and you'll find, you know, all the information. He wanted to carry out this attack on the anniversary, so 9/11, 2002. And he was arrested 2 weeks before, carrying it out. And apparently, he had him and his buddies, including his wife, had done rehearsals at the site prior, because people are not always there. In their plan, they included that they were going to shoot even the paramedics and the police that come and try to save people. And eventually, when he was captured, he pleaded guilty. He said he was mentally ill. Of course, when white people commit crime in America, they always say they're mentally ill and the world believes them. That's not any diss on white people. It's just the reality. However, imagine if a Muslim was planning to had these weapons and was planning to bomb a church, they would not consider mental illness as part of the equation. It would automatically, of course, and rightfully so, would be treated like a terrorist. Now, one thing that upset me about this case back then was the media never called this guy a terrorist, even though everything he was doing, equated to terrorism. So I saw the double standards in that, and that kind of upset me and said, you know what, I need to do more to educate people on who we are and to make sure that this type of stuff does not continue to happen. And that's why I got involved in this work. So now, just for some interactive, and it's okay to respond during this part, I want to ask you, what are some of the stereotypes that are out there about Muslims? Maybe not the ones that you yourself harbor, because I'm sure all of you don't hold any stereotypes against anyone, but maybe, you know, some of your neighbors that don't come to the school, what do you think they think of Muslims? What? ISIS? Okay, so that's one. Yeah, ISIS is a group. We'll talk about them. Any other stereotypes about Muslims? And don't be, shy. You know, you can be offensive, because these are not really your views. They're somebody else's views. Yes. Really dangerous. Yes, I wish I could be really dangerous. I don't know how. If somebody's dangerous is coming at me, I'll start running. But So any other comments about stereotypes? Bombs. Okay. I don't know if bombs is a stereotype. I don't know if you have stereotype class here, but that would have been appropriate if I would have asked, what comes to mind when you think Muslims? Bomb, okay, maybe. But it wouldn't necessarily be a stereotype. Yes. They're all radical, okay. Oppressed women, okay. Yes, I've heard that. Come to my house and find out who's oppressed. There'll be two stories. Now, these are some of the labels that you might find. Terrorists, radical, Saddam, Osama. You know, in fact, kids, Muslim students that are bullied in schools, and you can imagine how Muslim students might be bullied, especially in public schools. They're called these things all the time. They're taunted, they're bullied, they're made fun of, they're mistreated because of people's perceptions of who they are, and somehow that they share, you know, these crazy things with the violent criminals, when we don't really apply the same standards when other people from other faith commit crime. Have you guys heard of somebody named Timothy McVeigh? Okay, well, some of the older people have heard of Timothy McVeigh. You should look him up. Timothy McVeigh was a white Christian male who served the military and armed forces here in the United States, and he bombed a government building in Oklahoma City, killing over 160 people way before 9/11. And in fact, when it happened, the first reaction, people went on television and said, oh, these must have been Arabs and Muslims that did it. A day later, they captured Timothy McVeigh. Now, Timothy McVeigh was sentenced to death since then. But people didn't turn around and start blaming all Catholics or all Christians as terrorists because of the actions of one person. And that's what happens with stereotypes. Because at the end, people are responsible for their own actions. And I shouldn't have to be responsible for the actions of somebody that's across the world that's committing crime. Of course, we should all speak out against violence. But it doesn't necessarily mean I'm responsible for what somebody else did. Now, back to us as far as Muslims and Christians. And in fact, I like to focus on a lot of things that we have in common. We do have a lot more in common than most people on both sides think. Some of the things that we have in common, we believe and worship the one true God. We're both part of the Abrahamic faith or traditions, same roots, and believe in life after death. And now, is that part of the Christian doctrine to believe that there's life after death? Or when you, in Christianity, if you die, that's it, game over, right? There's something after death. So that we share the same thing. Now, imagine we believe in Jesus and Mary, and I'll mention more about that. Now, in order to be a Muslim, there are six things that we have to believe in, and there's five things that we have to do. The first thing that we have to believe in is to believe in the one God, the one true God. We call him in Arabic Allah. But that just happens to be his Arabic name, or his name in Arabic. Now, are there Catholics in Mexico? Yes. Now, do they call God in Mexico God? Does anybody speak Spanish? Yeah, okay, you're pointing some guy in the back there. What is the word for God in Spanish? Dios. Now, if somebody says, imagine if somebody says, those Mexicans do not worship the same God as our God. Our God is the one true God. They worship Dios. Wouldn't that sound ridiculous? Yes. It happens all the time on the 700 Club. This guy, Pat Robertson, goes on television and says, those Muslims, they worship a different God. Their God is Allah. Our God is God. Well, that's the name in Arabic. Just like Germans who are Catholic or Christian do not worship, they speak a different language. In fact, Christians who are Arab, because there are Arabs who are Christian, they also worship and believe in Allah. Because that just is the name of God in the Arabic language. We also have to believe that God has angels. We believe in God's angels. This is a creation that God created. In our faith, angels don't have free will. The supreme angels is Gabriel and Michael, just similar to what Christians have in their faith. And there are many other angels. They have different tasks, different responsibilities. We believe that they're made up of light, and they're different than us. Now, we also don't think that the devil or Satan is an angel that went bad. For us, Satan is from a different creation. It's called jinn. And this jinn is a different creation from the angels and separate from them. And the jinn, they differ from the angels because jinn, in our faith, have free will. We also have to believe in God's messengers from Adam all the way to Muhammad. And that includes Abraham, Moses, Isaac, Jacob. So many of the prophets and messengers that are mentioned in the Bible, we also have to believe in them all equally. We don't just believe that Muhammad is the last messenger and prophet that God sent in a chain of messengers. So just like when Jesus came, he wasn't the first person that God sent. There were people before him. In fact, Jesus had said, I did not come to abolish the laws or of the prophets. I came to fulfill them. So Jesus, in a way, was a continuation of what Moses and Abraham and others have brought before. For us, Muhammad, this is what we believe, Muhammad is a continuation of what Abraham, Moses, Jesus have brought. He is just a continuation of that. We believe that they're all the same faith, just different messengers were sent to different locations. We have to believe in all of God's sacred books, and that includes the Old Testament, the New Testament. We also believe in the Quran. You may not believe that the Quran is the Word of God, but we believe that the Quran is the Word of God. And just like you have the Old Testament, New Testament, we believe the Quran is the last testament. So we don't deny the existence of previous sacred books. We believe that they exist, and we have to believe in those books. We just simply say that God sent another book. And just how he sent, you know, revelation before, God is capable of sending revelation again. We also believe in life after death, that there is at one point when we die, God will resurrect us all, and we will face judgment for the actions of how we lived in this world, and then there'll be eternal heaven or eternal hell. Those are the things that we believe as far as life after death. Of course, it's not that simple. Even ones that enter heaven or hell, God's mercy has to do a lot with that. It's not just clear-cut on the scales. Then we also believe in something called divine predestination, that God has a will for individually and collectively for all of us, and that will come to pass. You know, and that gets into a whole different debate, you know, whether humans have free will or not free will. But in general, we believe that God's will come to pass. We also have to do five things. So the six articles of faith are things that we actually have to believe in. The five things that we have to do in order to say that we're a practicing or observant Muslim. One, we have to declare something called the testimony of faith, and to declare in our heart that we will only worship the one true God and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. And when we say that, that means we're going to follow the example of Muhammad in worshiping God. We have to perform five daily prayers. We have to give an annual charity of alms, which works out to be about 2.5% for those that can afford to do so. And we have to fast the month of Ramadan. The month of Ramadan is a month-long fast that we do, and we don't eat or drink from before sunrise to sunset daily for 30 days. Now, after sunset, we can eat and drink what we want until the next morning before sunrise, or approximately about that. And that's also something that we have in common with Catholics, because they also have a form of fast. I understand it's a little bit different than this, but fasting is a tradition that God had sent to Muslims and to people before us. And finally, Muslims have to make a pilgrimage once in their lifetime to a holy site that's sacred to Muslims in Mecca. Mecca is a city in what is now called Saudi Arabia. 100 years ago, Saudi Arabia did not exist. So before that, it was just the Arabian Peninsula. There's a city there called Mecca. And when Muslims go there, they are following the footsteps of Abraham and Ishmael. Now, how many of you have heard of Abraham? And how many of you know of Abraham's children? Okay. Now, Abraham, and according to our tradition, had two prominent children. One of them was named what? Isaac. And the other one? Ishmael. So Ishmael, in our tradition, when Abraham at first could not have any children, God gave him permission to marry Hagar, who was a woman in Egypt and who was enslaved by the Pharaoh. And she was traditionally or originally a princess from a different part of Egypt. And when he married her, she gave him her his first son. His name was Ishmael. And for 13 years or about, at least this is what we believe in our tradition, Ishmael was the only son. And at some point, Sarah, his original wife, was able to give birth to Isaac. And at that point, God ordered Abraham to take Ishmael and his wife Hagar to the desert, and he left them in a place called Mecca. And that's and Muhammad is a descendant, our prophet Muhammad is a descendant of Ishmael. Jesus and all the other biblical prophets are descendants of Isaac. The children of Israel, all of that, the tradition that's in the Bible, they are descendants of Isaac. So this is why we claim Abraham as the father of the three monotheistic faith, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And when we go to do our pilgrimage in Mecca, we're actually following the footsteps and the traditions of Abraham, Hagar, and Ishmael. And here's a picture of me when I performed my pilgrimage. When we go there, for the days that we are in pilgrimage, we all have to wear these white sheets. And whether you're rich or poor, regardless of your status, whether you're a king or you're a peasant, from all over the world, you know, millions of people descend on Mecca once a year, but it's not repeatedly. It's individually, you only have to go there once in your lifetime. So it's different people every year, and they go through this ritual, dressed the same, all on the same, you know, setting. As far as numbers, in the world, there are 1.6 billion Muslims. That's a lot of Muslims in the world. One in every fifth person in the world is a Muslim. So imagine if Muslims are really radical, Muslims are really violent, if the fifth of the world population was behaving along those stereotypes, well, there wouldn't be a world left because there'll be chaos everywhere. And that's not really the case. 6 to 8 million Muslims in America. It's a small number, so in America we're not in large numbers, but everywhere else or in a lot of other places, especially in Asia, Africa, the Middle East, in Europe, there are in far greater numbers. One of the fastest religions in the world. Now, some of you might ask about these guys. Okay, we've been seeing a lot of these evil monsters on television doing some crazy stuff. And they call themselves ISIS or ISIL. We don't like to call them ISIS because ISIS stands for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and we don't think that they're Islamic to begin with. It would be like if a bunch of criminal gang members who happen to be Catholic decided to go out and start doing a criminal activity, killing people, and then calling themselves the Catholic State. And then the media calling them the Catholic State. Just because they identify themselves or give themselves the name Catholic State does not mean they're Catholic or they're a state. At the end of the day, they're just a bunch of thugs that are criminals. And that's what we think of ISIS. But how did they come about? Because they didn't exist 2 years ago. Well, I'd have to take you back to the Iraq invasion of 2003. And this is where it kind of gets a little political, and this is my perspective, my analysis on what happened. In 2003, in response to 9/11, George Bush decided to invade Iraq, even though none of the hijackers on 9/11 were from Iraq at all. None of them were from Iraq, none of them were from Afghanistan, but one of the places that they decided to bomb was Iraq, and they did this shock and awe on the first day. I don't know, in 2003, how old you guys were. Did anybody remember watching this on television? Okay, you're watching TV at 2 years old, or? No, okay. So this was very devastating. It turned, you know, Iraq was invaded, and Iraq became this. Okay, devastated, infrastructure blown. So much was spent on this war. It's probably, in my estimate, one of the biggest mistakes that we ever did. Because it destabilized this government. Sure, Saddam Hussein was an evil dictator that should have been removed, but I'm sure we could have found other ways to do that rather than displacing so many people, destroying a country, and killing so many individuals. Because see, when and the biggest death toll in Iraq was not Saddam's army, was not the terrorists. The biggest death toll that happened in Iraq were civilians. And guess what happens when you kill civilians? Well, they get upset. And then that actually only fuels more violence and more terrorism because people now want vengeance. Well, who bombed me? Who killed my parents? Who killed my mom? Why am I like this? Why? Where's my school now? And when people start asking themselves questions and realize that the Americans invaded their country and did all these things, well, it puts us at risk. So the way that they carried it out and the aftermath of how what happened after the invasion, of not being able to help the Iraqis rebuild because, you know, we did bomb it. It was a lot of people in government didn't realize how difficult it was to rebuild a nation after war. Now, so that's what happened in Iraq, and they're still struggling to get back to where they were, and they're having difficulties. Next door, Syria. Now, just to tell you where Syria is, this is the world. Of course, you know the United States. Syria is that little red spot. It probably fits like, you know, in where Georgia is, or even smaller. You see the red spot? That's Syria. Now, when we hear about Syrian refugees and the war that's happening in Syria, just remember how small that is. So, in proportionate to the world, now how can these guys, the little red spot, regardless of how big they are, how can they pose a threat to us all the way in the United States? Well, it's really hard to, because in order to get to us, they'd have to go through a lot of stuff, including the Atlantic Ocean. So when people try to say, well, we're under threat by these maniacs over there, yes, there are maniacs over there, but really, how real is that threat? Now, the Syrians were and continue to be ruled by this guy in the blue suit. He's a dictator. His name is Bashar al-Assad, and he's basically running a military state in Syria. Something happened in 2011. Arabs started deciding that they want to have more freedoms and overthrow their dictators and have democracies like we have in the West. So they started protesting peacefully in the streets. Bashar al-Assad and his military generals responded by bombing them. Bombing who? Bombing his own people. So imagine, like, let's say you have some protests here in the United States, and instead of, you know, sending in the police to kind of contain them, no, you start bombing them and killing your own citizens because you want to remain in power. Now, that's what was happening, and it's been going on for 5 years now, and Syria now looks like this. Now, if your home is crumbling and you have nowhere to, and you don't have water systems, you don't have hospitals, you don't have schools, there's nothing left in your town except a bunch of rubble, well, you're going to try to get out of there, and that's where refugees, come about. Well, when there's empty land and there's no infrastructure and there's no police and there's no security, well, these guys, it makes it easier for these guys that are dressed in hoods and driving Toyotas to come in because and take the land because no one else is there. So the point that I want to try to drive here is that the chaos that has happened because of the Iraq war and because of what's happening, and these two countries are neighboring countries, because of this chaos and violence, it has allowed groups like ISIS to move in without really much confrontation and take up all this land, and wherever they can kidnap individuals and, you know, do these barbaric things for the world to see, to get attention, to seek legitimacy, and basically to try to pull people in to come in to fight them. You know, they can't come all the way to the United States. They don't even have a single plane. Okay, imagine all of this ISIS. They don't have a plane to ride on to get to us. So what do? They start taunting the United States and say, hey, come fight us here. They kidnap our people wherever they can. They do these videos on television to seek us to drag the U.S. into, or the West, into a fight on, you know, in the rubble, basically. And unfortunately, the civilians are paying the toll and they're escaping because now they have to not only escape the bombings of Bashar al-Assad, who is still in power, but now ISIS that's moving in. And by the way, ISIS, which numbers around, you know, 30 to, some people say, as many as 70,000 fighters. Most 90% or more of the people that ISIS has killed are other Muslims. They're not out there just trying to target Christians and Americans. They're predominantly killing other Muslims that are standing up to their oppression or their perverted version of radicalism. Now, I just want to, all this is driving, of course, it's not helping, because on CNN and on Fox News and on television, all day long, all they talk about, it seems like, ISIS. ISIS did this, ISIS did that. It's like the biggest propaganda tool for ISIS. They couldn't ask for, you know, 2 years ago, no one heard of this group. We didn't ever even heard of them. And now, they're almost like the spokespeople for Islam worldwide. Like I said, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. they're not acting. Maybe 0.0001% of them are like ISIS. Very small, you know, almost insignificant number, but because they're so loud and the things they're doing are so barbaric and they put it on for, you know, on social media for people to see, and then the media just starts broadcasting it disproportionately as if, you know, we're about to be invaded by ISIS when that's not going to happen. In fact, and, you know, in the meantime, there's all these mass shootings that are happening in America. In fact, this year, there was like, you know, almost 400 mass, or in 2015, almost 400 mass shootings that have happened in the United States. The president, at one point, when he challenged the media to put up the statistics to compare how many people were killed by terrorists, foreign terrorists, compared to how many people are killed by mass shootings. And it was something like, since 9/11, and it was something like 240,000 people have been killed because of gun violence and mass shootings, compared to, like, you know, less than two dozen have been killed from foreign terrorists. So, and there have been other statistics. We are more likely to be struck by lightning three times or more than to be killed by a terrorist in the United States. So we have so many more other problems that are impacting us than the terrorist threat. I'm not trying to undermine the terrorist threat. Terrorism is a major problem. It needs to be fought. It needs to be stopped. It needs to be contained. And we need to find other ways to do it rather than just bombing people over there, because I think that just creates more violence. However, we should not overstate the threat and just freak people out and spend so much money to justify, which justifies spending so much money on security, war, only when people are, for example, are in poverty in the United States. People don't have health care. People don't have all these other issues. Of course, that's my own political opinions that I'm interjecting. But so much of this between religion and politics, you know, come together in a lot of these issues. One thing that I also want to mention is the rising anti-Muslim bigotry. All these things are allowing bigots that have bigoted views to come on television and to go to mainstream America and share these views, and they're not being challenged on it. And this is something we call Islamophobia, and Islamophobia is basically a dislike of or prejudice against Islam or Muslims. It's kind of similar to anti-Semitism. Have you guys heard of anti-Semitism? Now, did you see what happened in Europe when anti-Semitism was not challenged during World War II? All right? What happened? What did it lead up to? The Holocaust. There's a danger when you allow, when a society does not challenge the bigotry that happens. Because there's a difference between personal opinions and dehumanization of other people. And when our people that are actively dehumanizing another race, another class of people, another group of people, that becomes very dangerous. Because when someone is dehumanized, then it allows individuals to do whatever they want to those people without being challenged. It has happened, you know, and in the world before. And it may happen again if we don't speak up against it. And here are some of the examples. Now, of course, you've seen this guy. You know, he's come on television and he actually said, ban all Muslims. Like, ban them. Don't let them in this country. And somebody asked him, what about the Muslims, that Americans who happen to be Muslim? He said, well, if they leave, don't let them back in. He's not the only one. Ben Carson, you know, you think he's African-American, he'd be sympathetic to minorities. But he just recently said this. This is just like 2 days ago. He said, you can't be a true Muslim and a true American, that Muslims who support American values are somehow schizophrenic. He actually said this on television. One thing that they are avoiding to share is something that many academics and historians know, that Muslims have been here in America from the beginning of America, even before America was founded. When Christopher Columbus came to the United States, or discovered America, which he didn't know was America back then, he thought he was going to India, when he stumbled upon this place, people on his ship, some of his navigators, were Muslim, because he was from Portugal, and Portugal and Spain were controlled and were led by Muslims for over 700 years, until the Inquisitions have happened, and you know, you could read more about that in your history books. But Muslims were there from the 700s, until 1490s, Muslims, were the rulers of that land. And while they were ruling that land, they allowed Christians, Catholics, and others to continue to worship freely as they were before. And when they were overthrown and kicked out, the churches were still there, and the society was able to continue being a Catholic society without much difference. Now, compare that to what happened when the Europeans came to America. It took a couple of hundred years to actually eliminate the Native Indians or the Native Americans from the land. And now, you know, as much as you see about the Seminoles or the Native Americans is casinos that, you know, when you drive by on the highway, and that's what they're limited to. But at one point, before most of us are here or our ancestors were here, people were on this land and they were Native Americans. But it's not just politicians. The media is often showing images like this. Now, when you see little kids with machine guns and, you know, they look Muslims and with headlines like why they hate us and the Muslim rage. Now, would you guys be upset if you saw Newsweek Catholic rage and then they find the most radical, probably somebody who's not even practicing Catholicism, and they put them on the headline as if that is representative of the faith? Well, this is how people's perceptions are being formed. And then people react like this and say, you know, go home. No Sharia in America. Sharia is basically our code of ethics, our Muslim law, how we govern ourselves. It tells us our dietary needs, like, you know, eat halal food. Halal food is like eating kosher. Have you heard of Jews eating kosher food? Well, we have our own dietary foods as well. It's very similar to kosher dietary needs, similar to what's in the Old Testament. But people want to ban that. Marriage and divorce and child care and all these issues that are part of our faith, people think somehow that's a threat if we practice our faith. Or some people think that that's a threat in America. And it's leading to people protesting outside mosques, trying to ban mosques from being built and to actually intimidate people that are attending in mosques. This one here on the left, and we've seen also a number of these, not only protests, but armed protests. This is where people show up to the mosque with their guns. Imagine, which is a recipe for disaster. People, you know, it's great to protest. It's one of our constitutional rights to protest and to express our freedoms. But when you combine that right of protest with a right to bear arm in the Constitution, and then people are really upset and charged and they show up to a protest with weapons, well, you're just, you know, putting fuel on a fire. You don't want to have weapons at a protest. When things get ugly, people have weapons, they can start shooting. Now imagine this, if a bunch of Muslims went outside of a synagogue with weapons or outside of a church, what would happen? The National Guard would come in and probably isolate these people, maybe ship them off to Guantanamo. But white Christians are able to do this all, you know, they've done it several times. And I'm not saying this is a majority, this is a small group that's doing this. But the government is not reacting the same way by protecting the Muslims. Now, fortunately, no one has been shot at these protests so far. The police was there and it got, difficult, but they were able to contain it. And it's continuing to happen, you know, saying, and this is a new thing now, people coming up and saying no to refugees, especially the Syrian refugees. I just showed you why there are Syrian refugees in the world. And America, which had been a beacon of hope for refugees from around the world to come here to the United States, to be able to have another opportunity. People that have already come here as refugees in the past or as immigrants in the past are now saying, you know, we're shutting the door, we're not letting more refugees in. I was really happy that Pope Francis yesterday at the border with the U.S.-Mexico border, this is him yesterday, this picture, he was there praying and decrying the suffering of migrants and refugees and called on the United States to accept the refugees. And this is really what it means to be a person that's worshiping God, because in reality is we shouldn't necessarily have borders that are keeping the people that need safety, that need to be able to get a better life out. And at least that's what Pope Francis was asking for yesterday. Picture was taken outside of a mosque. Now, do you see the guy in the background with the gun and the mask, and he's following this Muslim woman? She's just going to pick up her kids from an Islamic school in Texas. And this guy is following her on the street. Like anywhere else, that would just look like that should not be happening. But when Muslims are targeted, unfortunately, these things are happening. This is outside of a church in Gainesville, Florida. Unfortunately, even some church marquees are now being used to spew hatred. You know, I'm not saying that this is the majority of churches, but these things speak volumes because they impact people's perceptions. They lead to hate crimes, and these are some you know, examples. This is a mosque that was burned. This is a house that's in Sarasota where the people burned the house and then sprayed, of course, the F word. We had to black it out for your viewing pleasures. We're making I'm laughing about it now, but it's horrific. And this was a refugee family. In fact, they're from Bosnia, and they escaped the war in Bosnia. They finally were able to buy their own home in Bradenton, Florida. And then they went away on the 4th of July weekend, and they came home and found their home like this. And in case they didn't get the message on the garage door, they got the message inside. It was also painted inside. I'm going to end with three stories. One, as far as this hatred, where it can lead to. These are three people. They're Muslim. They're from North Carolina. The gentleman, his name is Dia Barakat, his wife Yosor, and her little sister Razan. He was in dental school. They're both at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And all the three of them were killed in their home by this guy, Craig Stephen Hicks. And, of course, the media put these headlines up. Parking dispute, not bias, triggered a murder. Now, I don't care what kind of parking dispute you're having, but parking dispute doesn't, no parking dispute is going to lead to going into somebody else's home and shooting them, assassinating them, basically, point blank, and then saying, oh, it was just because of parking. This person exhibited many hateful comments on his Facebook page in the past, and of course, he has very little interaction with Muslims, doesn't know many Muslims, and then found these three individuals. And they ended up being killed. And we now call them our three winners because they were young people that had so much and they accomplished so much in their life in such a short time. But you can imagine how this rising hatred could lead to violence. Another story is about this kid. How many of you have heard of Ahmed Muhammad, also known as the clock boy or clock kid? This kid is the one that basically built a clock and went to his school to show the teacher, hey teacher, look, I just made a clock at home. And she called the police thinking it was a bomb, and then he ended up being arrested. And this is him in handcuffs being arrested. President Obama tweeted to him saying, hey, I like your clock, you want to come show it to us at the White House? That was a nice gesture from President Obama, but you know, these things are continuing to happen in schools. Final story, it happened here locally. This happened about maybe 8 years ago. I got a call from a reporter at the Tampa Bay Times. Back then it was called the St. Petersburg Times. And they're like, well, we want to get your reaction about this interesting display in Pinellas Park. Now, I've seen some interesting displays in Pinellas Park, but nothing like this. And basically, this is a toilet that's in a front yard of somebody's house. And it has a sign that says Quran flush. And I didn't know if this toilet was there without the sign before, and it was just for public use without any walls, or what was going on. But I just took pictures of it to document it. And as I was taking the pictures, the owner of the house opened the door because I was in his front yard. And because when the reporter called me, I was like, you know, I don't want to comment about this until I go and actually see it. And I wasn't planning on talking to the guy. I was just going to look at it, and I saw it, and I was like, oh my God, let me take this picture. And that was before, like, we took selfies with the sign. So it was just... So then as I was leaving, the guy's like, hey, what do you want? And I'm like, oh... and then I guess he was, and I'm like, oh, I don't want anything. I was just admiring your sign. It's pretty interesting. Why do you have this here? And he said, oh, and at the time there was this big issue in Guantanamo Bay, which is a prison that's in Cuba, where the U.S. government or military has been putting Muslim prisoners there. And there was a story that the prison guards had abused or desecrated a Quran and urinated on it or something else, and they were getting in trouble for it. So this guy said, I want to show solidarity with those boys and our soldiers in Guantanamo that desecrated the Quran by desecrating my own Quran and not getting in trouble for it. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Okay. And I said, well, but why? He said, well, all you Muslims are terrorists, this, that, and you don't condemn terrorism, and anyway, he had a lot of misinformation. And I said, well, no, we're actually condemning terrorism. And I had something on my laptop to show him. So I said, let me grab my laptop. And of course, he said, well, why don't you come in? He was cooking. And when I came closer, he was actually holding a knife. And I was like, oh, my God. I don't know what I'm getting myself into. So I texted my wife, you know, my location. That was before we could check in on Facebook. I don't think Facebook existed with check-in back then. But I did send a text message to my wife with the address in case something happened to me. So I went inside in this guy's home in Pinellas Park who had this display outside. And when I went in, he had a huge picture of Rush Limbaugh. You guys know Rush Limbaugh? And he said, let me introduce you to my idol. And I was like, okay, this is where the problem is. And we couldn't find anywhere to sit in his house because he just had clutter everywhere. I was like, how do you live in this place? I didn't say that, of course. I didn't want to irritate him. And then he said, we couldn't find anywhere to sit except his bedroom. And even in his bedroom, there was no seats. We ended up sitting on his bed. And I was looking at the walls around me, and then he had all these rifles on gun racks. And I'm like, this might be the end. And then he, you know, I started showing the videos like, oh, I didn't see this stuff on my TV before. I said, well, you're not going to see it, you know, watching Fox News. And then we're talking and stuff. And I was, you know, ended up showing him pictures of my kids, and he was showing me pictures of his kids, and I just realized like, the guy was lonely. And then as I was about to leave, he's like, you know, I'm going to take down the sign. I said, oh, I didn't even ask you to take down the sign. I said, you know, you don't have to take it down. I mean, if you want to, you could, but you don't have to. I was more afraid for him than anything else. And then he said, no, you're such a nice person. You're the first Muslim I met. And you're so nice, and you took time out to actually talk to me. And, you know, I don't want to offend you. I still think your religion is evil, but at least you're not. And, you know, if the sign bothers you, then I'm going to remove it. I said, oh, look, can I take a picture of you removing it? He's like, yeah. And this is Michael Allen. He's in Pinellas Park. I think he's on 62nd Avenue. And this is him picking up the sign and then throwing it in the garbage. Way before, like, people were tweeting stuff and using Instagram, I was starting the trend back then. But that's my presentation. Thank you very much. We're going to make some time for question and answer. Some of you have questions, and no question is a silly question or offensive. So this is your chance to interrogate a Muslim willingly. Now, of course, I shared some stuff in here about the war and what I think is why ISIS got created. I don't think there's an Islamic reason for it to be created. It's not a religious, it's more political, and that's my political perspective. Other analysts may have different opinions, but I definitely don't think that they are Islamically justified because we have so many verses in the Quran that talk about how life is sacred and you can never kill an innocent person. So killing innocent people is basically a license to be sent to hell unless somehow the person repents and is forgiven by God and God accepts that repentance. Otherwise, if somebody actually kills other people and does not repent, does not get forgiveness, according to the Islamic faith, that person would be sent to hell. And that would include also suicide bombers. Because guess what happens? If you kill somebody in a suicide attack, well, you don't have a chance to ask for forgiveness after that. So your last act from a Muslim perspective, if you're doing a homicide, suicide type situation, well, you didn't seek forgiveness. There's no way you can forgive while you're dead or ask for forgiveness once you die. So that person is automatically going to go to hell. So individuals that, you know, try to come and say that Muslims that commit suicide attacks or suicide bombings, that somehow they're promised heaven in the Islamic tradition, that's a lie. And definitely Muslims don't believe that. Thank you.
Okay, so when someone says to you that Muslims don't deter terrorism, that they don't speak out against it, where do you send them, like... Where do they look?
Yeah, all you have to do is just Google. I mean, you know, Google is awesome. Just type in Muslims condemn terrorism, and you'll find hundreds or thousands and thousands of video statements that are out there. But this is often repeated, and they expect us somehow to go out there and just stop the terrorists. I mean, the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia. Like, the U.S. is in a coalition of 50-some nations. They're all bombing ISIS, apparently, and they can't stop these terrorists. But somehow they expect me to stop terrorists. You know, how am I? I'm just another individual. So terrorism is kind of a complicated thing because it's not a product of religion. It's a product of politics and political grievances and war. Now, some of these terrorists now are using this language of religion only to get legitimacy among its, you know, its people, because that's kind of the thing to do now. But had this been like these terrorists are in Russia, they would have been using the language or the things to gain legitimacy in that culture. And unfortunately, these individuals are finding ways to misuse and misinterpret religion and text to be able to recruit people, and it's putting us in a difficult situation. But we are openly condemning it. We're denouncing it. But also, it's kind of unfair because unless we do, the people think that we're with the terrorists. Why not? The natural thing to do is, unless I actually speak in favor of terrorists, you or people should assume that I'm against the terrorists, because our human nature is against crime. Our human nature is against death. But for people to assume, unless I go out and speak out against terrorists, that somehow I'm with them, that's contrary to the standards that we use for most people. Most people, we kind of say, you know what? They're innocent until proven guilty. So until we find the, you know, you actually come across a Muslim who is saying, hey, I'm with ISIS, let's go get them, then for the most part, you should just assume this is a good person. Because that's how we do with other people. If I meet you right away and you tell me your name is, what is it? Angelica, and say, oh, she's with the terrorists. Because those Catholics, you know. Then I'm already assuming, based on my stereotypes, and look, her friend's already moving away. Based on the stereotypes I have, or if I see a black person, oh, and he has his pants lower, and he has, like, you know, I don't know, run DMC, or like, you know, something, Thug Life, or whatever, and right away I'm just assuming, oh, this guy's bad news. He must be one of those, you know, and then he pulls out his ID from Harvard or something. Then that means I'm just judging him based on what society tells me to fear this person, unless he says, hey, you know, those criminal guys, those gangbangers and whatever, I'm against that, then I'm going to assume he's with them. So let's try to judge people based on their actions. If you meet somebody, just judge them on what they do. And it's unfair to kind of put us all, say, you know what, you guys are all with the terrorists until you prove otherwise. And then we're going to spend our whole life trying to prove we're not terrorists. Well, that's kind of unfair. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
This is WMNF Tampa 88.5 FM.